So last time we started out by talking about the main subject of our lab yesterday, which was make and make files. We had this idea that we'd specify these rules where we'd say, here's a target, something I'd like to build. Here are its prerequisites. Here are the commands used to build it. And make would look at what depended on what and figure out what commands it needed to run and not run commands it hopefully didn't need to run. We also mentioned that, well, there's some tools for making this a little more automated. So you can make these sort of pattern rules. You don't have to type, you know, that the way you make an O file from a C file is by writing the C compiler every time. And you could have variables so that if you wanted to change what the C compiler is, you could do that in one place rather than needing to edit every single place you invoke the C compiler, for example. Then we started talking about support that processors have for operating systems and sort of how operating systems provide some of the functionality they do. A big thing we're focusing on is kind of sharing machines. And one thing with sharing machines is that we don't want every program that runs on the machine to be able to do anything. Like if you're running a program on Portal, it shouldn't be able to read my files or vice versa. And sort of underneath, well, we have some code that's like talking to the disk. So it's communicating with the disk somehow. And you know, the disk doesn't actually know who owns what on it. It just takes commands to read. So we need to have some code that sort of actually enforces those sort of policies. And the hardware provides us a mechanism to help out with this, which is known as sort of kernel mode. That there's this sort of one-bit register which says if we're in kernel mode. And if we are, some operations, like talking to the hard drive, are allowed to work. And if we aren't, they don't work. And using this, we can ensure that only OS code gets to run those special operations. Now, the problem we have with this is that, well, my program, which shouldn't run in kernel mode because it shouldn't be allowed to do all these dangerous things, still needs to access those dangerous operations. Like, I still need to be able to read from the disk, just only the parts of the disk that are my files. So what we do is we have a way of making a request to the operating system code that will run in kernel mode. But we can't just let you run anything in kernel mode, and we can't even just let you run any part of the OS in kernel mode, because then you could like jump past the check for, is this a file you're allowed to access? So instead, we have this mechanism called a system call, where the processor, when it gets a system call, will jump to the OS's code at a location the OS set up earlier, typically at boot. And because the OS set this location, it made sure that when it set this location, that it was a location that's safe. That at that location, probably the first thing we're going to do is figure out what does the program want to do and are they allowed to do it? And if the answer is no, we're just not going to keep going. And because this is the only way the program can request these kernel mode operations, this allows our operating system to enforce that the program doesn't get to do things beyond what the person who wrote the operating system decided it should be able to do. We mentioned that with system calls, you know, that you could make these directly from programs, but typically you don't. So you have some operations which ultimately require doing something in kernel mode. Like if you're printing to the screen, that's going to require doing something in kernel mode because we don't let every program directly access the screen. That's going to be done by the US, who decides, oh, who's owns, you know, what programs are actually, you know, in the foreground right now and handles, what if two programs want to print at the same time, handles all of that. So it requires kernel mode to do it, but typically we like call like printf. Printf doesn't, you know, itself print to the screen, but there also isn't a system call called printf. Instead, printf is a library function like many others, which is implemented using system calls eventually. But most of the work printf does is going to be in user mode, where it's going to sort of turn your request into most likely simpler system calls. We also saw that there were some functions where what, where the function you call is like really similar to the system call, in which case maybe that function basically all it does is make a system call for you. But in either case, you're not making a system call from your C code because, well, a function call isn't the same thing as a system call. So we need something to translate between the two. And typically what we'll have is we'll have some functions written in assembly that contain the special system call instruction. Okay, so questions on things we covered last time? Yes?
If you have multiple printf in a file, does it switch to kernel mode every single printf, or does it switch one time and process all of them?
So question is, if I have a bunch of printfs, how many times does this switch to kernel mode? And the answer is basically it depends on how printf is implemented. So every time we're displaying something on the screen, we probably need to switch to kernel mode because generally our programs don't get direct access to I/O devices. So kind of the minimum number of times that we have to go to kernel mode is, well, however many times something new shows up on the screen. And the maximum number of times is, well, printf could separately make a request to the system for every single character. And in practice, probably something in between happens. That printf tries to avoid making tons of system calls, like one for every character, because if we did that, that's actually pretty slow. That a system call probably takes something on the order of like a microsecond, which isn't that long, but like if you're printing 1,000 characters, that's gonna start adding up. But we don't want to like hold off printing on the screen. And certainly, like if you're printing a line and you expect it to appear right away, it has to make a system call for that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, so in the reading there's an example where you put like a number for like the system call in RAX before it began. So what's the difference between that and then like jumping some specific place in the kernel memory?
Okay, so what's the difference between setting RAX and jumping to a specific place in kernel memory? So we talked about having this OS specified location. So that OS specified location is basically going to contain code which is going to be like, if RAX equals equals zero, do read. Else, if RAX equals equals one, do write. So it's going to contain code like that. And well, probably this is actually going to be like a switch statement or something more efficient, but it's going to have this sort of structure where it's going to check RAX. And this kind of gives us a list of the possibilities. Are every value of RAX it checks for, those are the only operations you can do. And this is kind of unlike if we had a system call operation where you specify the address of something in the kernel, where you know it's potentially any code in the kernel, in the OS, I should say. And this is very deliberate because we want to be very careful about what operations we allow. Does that answer your question? Some people look confused, so I assume there's more questions, but maybe not. Okay, so some notes on the lab, just from talking with TAs and hanging out briefly in some of the labs. Some issues that TAs and or I saw that might be worth talking about. So apparently a bunch of you didn't actually check that the program we built ran. So probably just something to keep in mind. So sometimes you might have, some people built programs that didn't work and didn't know it. We saw a bunch of people who set C flags and LD flags, so they set these variables in their makefile and then didn't use them. So yeah, we could change them, but they didn't do anything. That's kind of inconvenient. A lot of people didn't seem to be careful about what target was first. So remember when we said when you just type make, that builds the first thing in the makefile. And if the first thing is like clean, that's probably not what people expect. People usually expect running make to do something like make all, to build a reasonable default. Some of you tried to use dynamic linking, which was not the easier option. If you didn't use dynamic linking, we need to be careful about making so it could find that libsay.so. And there are kind of two options for doing that. So one was setting LD library path, which is an environment variable. I'm not sure if environment variables are covered in CSO1. So in the shell, you can set this by doing export LD library path equals and some value after the equal sign. And LD library path's a runtime setting, so it needs to be set before you run a program. Alternately, you could use the rpath option, which would sort of build a path into the program to search through. Also, I ran across a bunch of people who uploaded their submission, great, and apparently like copy-pasted, and that doesn't preserve tabs. And we mentioned that before the commands, it needs to be a tab character, so I couldn't auto-grade any of those, because when I ran make, it didn't work, because there weren't tabs there anymore. Something to be careful of. From what I understand, I think the most common way people in CSO1 are used to transferring files was like via Git, which would be a fine option. Otherwise, you can use SCP, would be another good option. Or if you're using remote desktop to the department machines, you can probably open up a web browser and upload directly if you're using the NX instead of SSH. And that will avoid issues of like copy and paste, like not actually copying exactly what was in the original file. And another thing is that, I just thought static should work, because why wouldn't it? But apparently some of the compilers on Portal are missing some of the libraries, like are missing like the static version, libc.a, even though they have libc.so, so it can sometimes give errors, which weird misconfiguration by our CS help desk people, but probably not a high priority for them. That caused some confusion for people. So questions about the lab, comments? Yeah.
I noticed that when compiling the executable, you have to put the object file before the static library file.
Oh, right, okay, order of libraries and verbs, yes. So if you're using your compiler, you want to have object files, then the libraries they need. It has to be this order. And the reason why, basically, is that the compiler is going to, when it finds a library, it's going to check for things that have already been listed that need that library. So if you haven't listed the things that need the library, it might say, I don't need to include all this library, even though it does. And this is why I think in CSO1 you were told to like put -lm at the end of the command line, and that's why you have to do that, because otherwise, if you put it earlier, it's going to say, oh, I don't need anything from lm, we're set, even though that's not really true. Other questions? Yes. Question, when compiling a shared library, you had to put -fpic?
It wasn't just compiling a shared library, it was like compiling.
So fpic, is needed for all object files that end up in a .so. So if you're making a shared library, you need to compile everything that goes into that shared library with -fpic. Does that match what you were experiencing? And the reason for this is that things that end up in shared libraries need to be able to be possible to load at arbitrary locations. And PIC stands for position independent code. So that's going to tell the compiler to write the assembly so the resulting machine code can be put anywhere in memory and still work, meaning that it can't hard code addresses in that machine code, whereas for an executable, that would be something it could do. Other questions? Yeah.
Real quickly, what was dash LM for again?
What was dash?
LM.
What is dash LM? So dash LM means the use the M library. And on most Unix-like systems, the M library is the standard math library, which has things like sine and cosine, and exponents and so on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so as I mentioned when I did logistics, we're going to have a quiz that's going to be due by next lecture. It's going to be released sometime this evening. It's not going to be released right after the lecture because depending on what I get to today, I might change the quiz, and I want some time to do that and have it hopefully be proofread by people who aren't me, so we avoid problems. So this is what the quiz system looks like. So you'll take a quiz like this. Normally a dialog prompting you to whether you really want to view the quiz will prompt up, but I already opened this, so it doesn't. And you can modify the answers here. And when you modify the answer, you'll see a green box around the question. If there's a green box, your answer has been recorded. If you go away from this webpage and come back, it will still be there. And whatever answer you have recorded before the quiz due time, that's the one we're going to take and grade. You can also type comments. So you can say, I think this question could also be interpreted as blank, in which case I'd answer E, something like that. And when you focus outside of the box, that comment will be recorded, box turns green, and we will have someone read the comments and adjust grades accordingly sometime after the quiz is due. So after the quiz is due, it will be auto-graded, but obviously we can't actually instantaneously read the comments. So reading the comments might take an extra week, in which case you'll see the scores be adjusted later on. So we can have select all that apply questions like this. On these questions, each option is worth a certain number of points. So yes, you can get points for leaving something blank. If the option isn't correct, you'll get points for leaving it blank. And you can have short answer questions like here. I don't know why. Yeah. And select one options like here. Some questions about that? Yes.
So once you open the quiz, you're allowed to open it as many times as you want to close it.
So the question is, once you open the quiz, you can open it as many times as you want to close it? Yes. And if you want to verify that your answer is recorded, you can reload it or just go back to the index and go back to it. And you should see the same answers there if things are recorded properly. And yeah, we'll take whatever is submitted last before the due time. And when, where is my mouse? There's my mouse. And after the quizzes are due, you'll see sort of something like this. So you'll see your score. Here, the correct answers are marked with a green T. And the percentages are the percent of students who gave each of those answers. So you can have an idea if a question was relatively hard or easy, or I can have an idea if, I can have an idea if a question was hard or easy, or I should check if it's keyed correctly, that sort of thing. If you write comments and a grader has gotten to it, you might see feedback from your comment, depending on what the grader thought about that. As I said, that might take about a week, depending on when people have time to grade. My guess is they might grade over the weekend afterwards or something like that. You can also submit regrade requests if you think we made a mistake. Note that because we don't look at your comments the first time until at least a few days after, yes, you can submit a regrade request right after the quiz is due, but if you had something in a comment, we probably just didn't look at it. It's not that we evaluated and said no, and we shouldn't adjust your grade. Yes? Questions for selecting nothing would be the right answer. Would that only apply for select multiple? Yes. So if it's a select one, you won't get points for selecting nothing. And okay, I say about sort of clarifications for the quiz. We have this comments field. If you think a quiz question is wrong or has multiple interpretations or so on, that's where you write that. Generally, I'm not going to answer questions about the quiz. The main reason why is like if you figure out there needs to be some clarification on the quiz on Monday, I don't want to like send an announcement out on Monday telling the people who did the quiz on Friday, sorry for doing the quiz early, now you have to look at it again. Especially if they decided to do it on Friday like because they're super busy on Monday. So instead, I'm just going to do the best with the quiz questions as written. If they're really bad, I'll drop them or accept additional answers besides the intended key, figure out based on what happens. But generally, I'm not going to like give clarifications on the quiz question. If you think the question has a problem, use the comments field to explain, you know, and we should give you credit, you know, if that was right. And if the question was really bad, we'll adjust the key for the question or maybe just drop it, give everyone credit for it. Other questions on quiz logistics? Okay, so on the quiz. So the first quiz released this evening and due before lecture next week. And there's one thing I should point out, that the quiz site is, you click here, this is one way of getting to the quiz site. It's not the demo site. Don't take the demo quiz and expect us to grade. Okay, so one other note is that there's a warm-up homework assignment. So it's just on the website. It's due next week before lab. Basically, it's due some simple C programming, where you can borrow some of the stuff you did in CS01 for, and add a makefile to it and submit it. Okay, so questions on that homework assignment? Yes?
Will the auto-graders for the homework like, give us instant feedback?
Question, will the auto-graders for the homeworks give you instant feedback? Probably not. So I guess what I usually do with auto-graders and what might change for some things is when the auto-grader finds that something's wrong, often I just have the leave it ungraded and go to it through it manually. So like that's what I did for the make lab. So that might happen like for some of these homeworks. And like for the make lab, that was kind of useful because like my initial auto-grader didn't handle some things correctly. And I prefer to look at them rather than tell you, you did something wrong, when it's in fact that the auto-grader doesn't know how to handle your makefile. And also I haven't written the auto-grader for the warm-up assignment yet, so if you submit now, it definitely won't get you instant feedback. Does that answer your question? Yeah. There isn't a limit to the number of submissions, yes. We only promised to grade your last submission, but there is not a limit. Other questions? Yes?
We got like S list features from like CS01. Are we still going to have access to all that?
You have like SSH?
Like the department. Like,
do you still have access to the department machines? Yes. If you do not, let me know and I will work on fixing that. Okay. Other questions? Question is, the auto-grader give you information about what went wrong? I haven't written it yet. So, but I don't expect, but often I don't write auto-graders that give me some feedback because I'm going to have me look at it if the auto-grader finds something weird, rather than showing you auto-grader output that might be hard to understand if you don't know how the auto-grader works internally. Depending on the assignment, of course, but. Question, before the deadline, we'll get any feedback? I won't guarantee it. I hope to do that, but I'm not going to promise it because that's not my highest priority versus like making sure the next lab and homework are ready to go. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So last time we talked about system calls, which is why you can read files, but not other users' files. Let's talk about some other things you shouldn't be able to do to other people's programs on Portal. So one thing you shouldn't be able to do is have your program modify the other program's memory. And when we sort of did our high-level overview, we alluded to how this worked, that there's this thing called address translation. So let's talk about sort of what sort of the semantics of that are. So let's say here I have program A and program B. And program A has a global variable at address 10000 hex. And does some work and then reads from that global variable into RX. And program B, which is going to be run at the same time, writes 99 to the same address. So first question here, in A, what do we expect RX to be at the end of this? So I have a bunch of options here. Check with your neighbors, see if you agree what should happen. And I guess I probably, if I was being careful in writing this assembly, this would be quad. It's not that type of a trick question. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, that it's gonna be just 42, the value that was assigned initially? Thinks B, it's gonna be 99. Thinks C, it's gonna be the address. Okay, how about D, it could depends on the timing. Okay, how about E, it depends on the timing and it might crash. Okay, and how about F, something else? Okay, so we have big splits here. Now, if we think of what we'd like to happen, if I'm running program A and you're running program B, it sure would be not very nice if what your program does can randomly break my program. Like, imagine I'm running a copy of my text editor and you're writing some buggy code and now my text editor's broken. That would be really inconvenient. And in fact, we have a mechanism to make it so it doesn't matter, and that means that the correct answer is going to be A. That program A is going to be unaffected by this nonsense that program B is doing. So I'm going to talk about how that's implemented as sort of a big topic in this class. So let's do the same question for program B. Well, I guess we'll talk about sort of how this might look. So we're thinking of program A and program B. They might, in fact, think they both have something at address 10,000. So maybe, like, 0x10,000 is here. And from the points of view of program A and B, they both have sort of global variables at that location, but they're going to be different global variables. That have the memory of program A, memory of program B. As far as these programs are concerned, they're kind of like independent of each other. Even though they might use the same address for different things, they're going to still refer to different writable data, different coding constants, a different stack. So you might say, how do we do that? And sort of the high-level idea, which we're going to talk a lot more about in a couple weeks, is that we have this abstraction called address spaces. And the implementation of that is the hardware supports setting a mapping between the addresses each program uses and the real addresses on the machine. So the programs see that memory looks like this. And obviously, it's impossible for this to be the real memory because there's two different things at the same location. But what's really happening underneath is that before the processor accesses memory locations, it goes through this mapping that the operating system set up that maps, say, address 10,000 to two different locations. You might also notice in this mapping, I have these big empty spaces. And that's sort of another thing supported by this mapping, that this mapping can have holes which will trigger an error. You might know of this error as a seg fault. Okay. So questions on this sort of address translation idea, that we take the program addresses and translate them to the real addresses. And this allows us to have the two programs sort of isolated from each other. Yes? So how can we have memory share between different programs? So conveniently, that's the next set of slides I have, is that when we set this mapping up, the OS can make the mapping, so it chooses the mapping function, so it can choose it to have part of the memory point to the same place for two programs. And on next week's lab, we're going to take advantage of this to have two programs deliberately share some data, you know, by asking the OS to do this for us. Yeah.
So how does it handle two programs accessing the same register?
How does it handle two programs accessing the same registers? So registers aren't part of memory, so they don't have a memory address, so they don't go through this. We're going to talk more about, well, I guess, so there's going to be some different mechanism to handle programs having different registers. So the simplest case is if we have two cores, each core has its own set of registers, problem solved. If we only have one core, we're going to get into that later today. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes? So the question, if I have shared code or data, how do I deal with, you know, if like I'm sharing libc, for example, how do I prevent programs from editing libc for other programs? And we're going to talk about this a lot more later when we talk about what's called virtual memory, which is what the format this mapping takes. But the short answer is that each of these sort of arrows is annotated with sort of read okay, write okay, and other kind of information like that that the processor will check when the program does a memory access. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah.
What happens when there is no, like, available space for the OS to map to?
Question, what happens when there's no available space for the OS to map to? So if the program asks for more memory and there's none available, then the OS has to say no or come up with some solution to free up memory. And you'll see OSs do both, depending on the scenario. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And as I mentioned, in lab, we're going to actually use shared memory a bit. And the main way we're going to do that is with this function we'll talk about later called mmap, which takes a file and puts it in your memory. And it's set up such that if two programs put the same file in their memory, they get the same memory. And that's the mechanism we're going to recommend for the lab. And we're going to use these special files created with SHM open, which are in-memory files, so we don't actually waste space on disk. But, so we have our address translation mechanism. Okay. So another thing that we know programs shouldn't be able to do is hang the system. So if I log into Portal and I run an infinite loop, let's say this program, we expect that you can still log into Portal and probably do stuff. And, well, if the machine you're logging into has multiple cores, it's easy to think of why this might be so. Well, there's no, you know, this is using one core, can't use multiple ones because each core sort of has its own program counter, own set of registers. But if we only have one core, it's still true that you could log into the machine and do stuff, even though I'm running this program that seems to have no escape. It's just gonna, once it gets on the processor, it seems like it's just gonna go on forever. So what's going on? And one way we can kind of investigate this is I have a sort of different version of this loop where I'm timing running this comment here. So I'm getting the time before and after it. And if we were directly on the processor, what we'd expect to happen basically is that it would take the same amount of time between each of our measurements. It wouldn't be zero because it takes, you know, some number of nanoseconds to read the time. So it should be a little more than zero, but it should be basically consistent. Just however long it takes to read the time should be the difference between the two timings. So here's a plot of me running that on my machine. I've just plotted the points, and it's a log scale in the y-axis. So usually, I get these nice consistent measurements that are, you know, 40, 50-ish nanoseconds. And sometimes, I get measurements which are 10 million nanoseconds. So there's this huge range. And a good question to ask is, well, what's going on when suddenly it seems like reading the clock takes, you know, 10 million nanoseconds instead of 60? So what's going on? And what we can think of this is that we have our program running, our loop, and what ends up happening is that it doesn't get to use our processor core all the time. It only gets put on the processor core sometimes. And with our timing, I'm noticing that there's these gaps where it's not actually running, and that's why it took so much time. That's why I measure this huge time. And from an assembly point of view, we can think of it that I measure the time, and there was this huge delay. That's what this program sees. But the core isn't just sitting doing nothing for that time. What's in fact happening is that other programs are getting to run. But you might say, wait a moment, I didn't write any code to make other programs run. Look at the instructions here. None of them say, go to another program. There's no instruction I wrote in my loop to do that. But somehow I end up going to another program. So how is this happening? Where is the code that's running to switch to SSH? And so there's a mechanism which is kind of a generalization of system calls called exceptions that's involved here. And it's going to let the operating system run in between. So some sort of exception is going to happen. This is a different kind of exceptions than like what you might have seen in Java. But an event we call an exception happens, and that's going to cause the operating system to run. In this case, even though there was nothing in our program that was triggering it. And the operating system is going to arrange that when it finishes handling this exception, that we end up in a different program. And by doing this, the operating system makes sure that I can't actually hang portal by running my infinite loop. Because somehow the operating system is going to get control, and I'm going to only end up getting the processor part of the time. But I get to write my program as if I had the processor all the time. I didn't need to write any extra code to deal with other programs being around. It just happened. So what we'd say is that I have this illusion that I have a dedicated processor. I write my program as if I am writing for being the only one on the processor. And the operating system implements this with some help from the hardware such that I don't actually hog the whole processor. I get to share that processor with other programs. But I, you know, write my program so I use my own values of RAX, RBX, and so on. I don't have to worry about other people also needing RAX and RBX. The operating system's handling that for me with some help from the hardware. I don't have to worry about my program counter value changing out from under me. That's going to happen. That happens, but somehow the operating system is going to undo that for me so I don't notice. And the implementation sort of does this, letting many of these threads, these sort of what programmers think is they have their own CPU, share one processor. And we'll talk about the main problem here, which is that if each of these threads has their own register values and their own program counter, where are those stored when they're not running? And the answer is going to be the operating system puts them in memory somewhere. So that we get time multiplexing. Some questions? This mechanism. Yes?
So for example, if I have a program that just print f from, say, 1 to 1 billion, and since it's a really long program, is the OS going to intervene partway into the program and then let on?
So the question is, how does the OS decide how often to intervene? So partly, this is a decision that different OSs will make differently. But we'll see that the hardware has some specific events that it will run the OS for. Some of them include things like if it gets information on the network, for example, that'll run the OS. And also, the OS can set up a timer, which is the most common way to handle the fallback case. So it can set up a timer that will go off and run the OS after some amount of time the OS chooses. But sort of the choice of how much do I want to switch away from your program, that's a design decision the OS has to make, and it's a trade-off, right? If you switch off a lot, then you're spending a lot of time switching, but you make it less likely that someone can hog the machine all by themselves. Other questions? Yes? How is an exception triggered? We will talk about several ways in which that can happen in a bit, very explicitly. Other questions? Okay, so this idea of sharing the processor is called time multiplexing, or dividing up time between programs. And sort of the mechanism for it is we have this exception mechanism. We'll talk about exactly what triggers exceptions later. But the key thing it does for us is it starts running the OS. And what the OS is going to do is it's going to save the old program counter and the old register somewhere for later, because we're switching to a new program. And then it's going to set the new registers and the new program counter for whatever program we're switching to. So in this example here, we're going to save the values for loop and restore values we saved earlier, presumably, for SSH. And this operation is called a context switch, because the information we save and restore we call the context. And I guess one thing that I wasn't explicit about being in the context here registers sort of and the address mapping. And it's going to set the new registers and address mapping. Some questions about this idea, context switch. So what we can think of as happening is initially we're say running program A. Program A is therefore has its register values and so on are stored on the processor. And the OS has a copy of the program that's not running right now, program B, and all its registers. They aren't on the processor because it's not currently running instructions yet. And when a context switch happens, the OS is just going to swap the two. It's going to put the saved values it had for program B onto the CPU and save the ones from program A into the memory for later. Yes?
Where does it actually save the data? Because I assume it's not going to main memory.
Question, where does it save the data? So the OS will usually reserve part of the memory for itself for this sort of bookkeeping. And using that that address mapping, it can set up that memory to be only accessible in kernel mode to keep other programs from accidentally interfering with this. Does that answer your question?
Does this have anything to do with caches?
Question, does this have anything to do with caches? This is kind of independent of caches. So like caches will apply to all this memory just like usual, but we'd write this code the same way if we didn't have caches, the OS code that does this. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So I talked about having this exception mechanism a lot, and we're going to talk about what triggers exceptions. And I have this sort of chart here of what triggers exceptions, and we can kind of think of two broad categories of event that triggers exceptions. So exceptions are this mechanism for running, you know, so way for CPU to run OS. So there are some mechanisms of triggering it which are what we call asynchronous, where they're unrelated to what the currently running code is doing. So externally triggered events. So we have, for example, I mentioned a timer. So operating systems will often set a timer before letting a program run. And when that timer goes off, it will trigger the OS to run. And that will let the operating system switch away from a program that might just be like running an infinite loop. Also, we have externally triggered events to notify the operating system about I/O devices. Remember that we reserve communicating with I/O devices most of the time for just stuff in kernel mode, so the operating system needs to handle that anyways. And this allows us to do things like handle a key press when the key press happens, rather than having the OS like repeatedly need to check for it. So for example, let's say I have a program that requests to read input. So we're going to make a system call to do that. And while we're making that system call, the OS probably isn't going to go back to our program from that system call. Instead, it's going to let something else happen. But then when the key press happens, we'll have an exception occur, so the OS, if it wants to, could run our program right away, rather than waiting for like a timer to go off. So like key presses or data coming in on the network, the OS will be notified by the hardware and get to run, so it can decide what to do about that key press or what to do about that data on the network. And sometimes the OS will decide to like run the program that needs to handle it right away. Sometimes it might decide not to, decide to just remember it for later. We also have exceptions for cases where the hardware wants to tell the operating system something is broken. So for example, some memory can detect when the memory values have been corrupted, in which case there's probably not much you can do, but you want to know about that, so they'll notify the OS with an exception that will run. The OS code that can decide what to do about that. We also have the second category of exceptions, which I call synchronous. These are things that are triggered by the code the current program is doing. And we've seen one case, which are intentionally triggered cases. And these are system calls. So system calls are a type of exception. And they're intentionally triggered, but they do the same thing as all these other exceptions in which they run the OS starting at a location the OS specified. So system calls are just us doing this deliberately, but it also happens not deliberately, like if we take too long. And we have this last category here that I label as sort of errors or events in programs. So when the hardware is running an instruction and doesn't really know what to do, it asks the OS for help using this exception mechanism. So for example, if you try to access memory that is listed as invalid in that address space, so it goes through the mapping and says there's nothing there, it's going to run the OS using this exception mechanism and ask the OS what to do. If you try to run a privileged instruction, so if you try to talk to the disk directly, but you're not the OS code, you're not running in kernel mode, then what the processor is going to do is it's going to say, hey, kernel mode code, what do you want to do about this program that tried to access the disk directly? Or if you, like, for example, divide by zero, or if you do an invalid instruction. So for most of these, it would seem like from this point of view that maybe the most common action you can think of the OS doing is crashing the program. That would be a common choice. There's also other things it might decide to do depending on the context. But, you know, we have to have the OS's help because the processor doesn't really know how to proceed after these events itself. So it's going to ask the OS for some help deciding what to do about the program that was running and what to do next. Like, if we aren't going to run the current program, the processor doesn't know how to switch to another program, but the OS does. So questions about these different exception triggering events? Yes?
So in the error case, it's not that, like, if it runs into like something that would crash a program, it's not really the program crashing, it's the program not knowing what to do when OS telling it to crash.
So the question is, if it runs into one of these errors, it's not really the program crashing, it's the program not knowing what to do. I would say the processor is not crashing. The processor asks the OS what to do, yes, and when you see it crash, what's happening is when the OS is asked what to do, it says, well, what I want to do in this case is crash the program. Yes?
So when you, like, let's say you had two programs and we're talking about, like, the I/O devices, the compressors and stuff, does the OS kind of have a way of knowing, like, if both of these programs are asking for input, like, which one, like, if you give it an input, which one goes to?
Question is, if two programs are asking for input at the same time, does the OS have a way of knowing which one it goes to? Yes, so the OS has to track that. So it's going to have some data structures to know if I'm waiting to read some things from the disk, for example, what programs am I waiting for? If I'm waiting for a key press, which program should get the key press? So the OS has to make those decisions and have the data structures to coordinate all that. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Where would backdoors fall into this?
So these are the mechanisms for running the OS. What the OS does after it runs, that's a separate decision, and that's where something like a backdoor would be, right? If there was some way of making the OS do something that it shouldn't do, if you wanted to have the OS do it, it would be triggered by one of these mechanisms because this is how all OS code is triggered. Does that answer your question? Sorry?
So with a trigger, would it be counted as synchronous?
The question is, if something like deliberately triggered a backdoor, would that be counted as synchronous or asynchronous? We generally count that as synchronous because probably we could point to an instruction that caused it. Right, like an invalid memory access or an illegal instruction or something. Does that answer your question? Or a system call? Other questions? Okay, so if you look at our readings have specific terms for each of these types of exceptions. They call this externally triggered exceptions interrupts, these intentionally triggered exceptions system calls or traps, and these errors or events in programs faults. I'm not using those terms much because in the real world, these terms aren't standardized, and everyone seems to disagree on what terms to use for what. I'm sorry. And I mention this mainly because, like, if you pick up Intel's manual and read it, you'll see that they call, like, everything interrupts. Or if you, like, open the source code to some versions of Unix, you'll see that they call everything traps. So it's not consistent. You have to figure out what they exactly mean. But this categorization is useful to let you know sort of there are these broad, very different things that all use this same mechanism, because the thing they want to do is run OS code with those extra kernel mode privileges. And what the hardware does, basically, is we detect that an exception occurred. So that could be that the programming instruction, while we were running it, we detected, oh, we can't continue, we need to do the exception thing. Or some signal came in from externally to the processor. Then we save the current value of the program counter somewhere, and we jump to what we call the exception handler, which is part of the OS, you know, that the OS set up at boot. And I'm going to describe sort of a simple version of this. If you look up how it really works in x86-64, there's a bunch of extra things going on that are mostly because of the storied history of 64-bit x86 and not because of things that are, like, really conceptually important for this class. But sort of basic idea is we're going to have some special register on the processor that you're only going to be allowed to set in kernel mode. And it's going to point to what we call an exception table. And that's going to have a pointer for each type of event that could trigger exceptions. And each of these pointers is going to point to the code to handle each kind of exception. So we'll have, like, a divide by zero handler, we'll have a timer interrupt handler, one of these will be, like, the handle syscall. So we'll have code that the OS set up at boot for each kind of event that could happen. And the hardware is going to do a lookup in this table and run that code. And before it does that, it's going to need to save the old program counter, because otherwise we can't go back to the program later. So it's going to save it somewhere. Hardware varies in where they save it. They could make it save it to an extra register. They could put it on to some stack. But hardware needs to save it somewhere. And the OS gets to decide what to do. So it can decide to switch to another program by loading new register values, and so on. And I guess, oh, I skipped over one thing. And I guess there's one other thing the hardware needs that I should mention that I forgot to have a slide for. So this return from exception operation, this is also going to require some hardware support, because this is going to be sort of a special instruction to go back to user mode. Because remember, our exception handler runs in kernel mode, has access to everything. When we go back to user mode, we want to be able to go back to having access to not everything. So there's going to be a special instruction to help us do that. It's going to be another part of what the hardware is going to help us support. OK, so questions? Yes. Question is the value of the exception table base register changed on every boot? That's up to the OS, because it's set by the OS wherever it wants to set it. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So if the operating system crashes a program, then how does it know not to go back?
Question, if the operating system crashes a program, how does it know not to go back? So it's the operating system's code that's handling, like, loading the register values, so it can just have an if statement to know not to go back. Does that answer your question? And I guess if you think of what the exception handler does when a program crashes, is that it just loads the values for a different program and starts running it. That, other questions? Yeah.
Let's say there are a million programs running.
Yeah.
Does the OS run a bit of each million?
Question, if there are a million programs running, does the OS end up running a bit of each program? It probably tries to. If they're all runnable, yes.
Timer interrupt exactly work, is it
Question, how does the timer interrupt work? So does it happen every clock cycle? Generally, no. So usually the way the timer looks to the OS is kind of similar to a keyboard, except like you kind of schedule your key press. And you get notified of it like you would get notified of a key press. So it's as if it's an external device that like you can send a message, say, give me a ping in 10 milliseconds, and that will happen. Does that answer your question? The question that has to be stored in the base register beforehand. So setting up the timer is like talking to an I/O device, like talking to the network. Like it's on the same, like it's in the machine, but the way the OS talks to it is the same kind of way it would like talk to the screen or the or a network. And it has to set up a handler in advance, something to happen when that timer informs the processor, hey, I'm ready now. But as far as configuring the timer, that's separate from the exception table. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Do system calls also access the exception table?
Question, do system calls also access the exception table? For our model, yes. This is one of the things that might be more complicated in practice, but not for reasons that are important to this class. Yeah. So the question is, the base value always stored in a certain register? So the model I'm showing here, we have a special register to store that base value. In practice, like different processors might have slightly different choices about how that's specified. But there's going to be some specification of where this table is. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. The question is the offset value added to the base, is that the exception number? So if we have something called exception numbers, that's probably what they are, yes, or the index into the table, which wouldn't be the offset exactly, but like which row? Because the offset of row number 1 is 8 because these are 8 byte pointers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. Can I describe in more detail what happens when a key press occurs? So when a key press occurs, the keyboard device is going to somehow notify the processor, there's a key press, and the processor is going to react by saving where the current program is and running the code in pointed to by one of these table entries. And that code gets to do whatever it wants. Probably in a typical OS, what it does is it saves the values that the current program was working on, checks what programs are waiting on a key press and decides whether or not to run them now. And also maybe stores the key press value somewhere for later. Is that? Question, does that happen even if the key press isn't supposed to do anything? Generally, yes. So if the OS didn't do that, probably the keyboard is, you know, so I guess the biggest thing is the keyboard probably only stores a very small number of key presses. So if you don't want to lose that key press, you have to get it off the keyboard device and store it somewhere in memory. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about here. So which of these things are going to require exceptions, and which are going to require context switches? I'll give you a few minutes. Check with your neighbors. Okay, who likes more time? So let's start with which require exceptions. So who thinks A requires an exception? How about B? Okay, C? C, okay. D? Okay, E? Okay, F? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that B requires an exception, and I agree. We don't allow programs to communicate directly with the disk because we're kind of sharing the disk between programs in a controlled way. We don't want you to write to the disk and overwrite someone else's data on the disk. And the way we're going to enforce that is by having the OS do all the writing, be the only one allowed to do writing, so it can make sure that that doesn't happen. So then let's go through some of the others. So we had less consensus on C, and I would say C requires an exception. We need some way of running the OS in kernel mode to do this, because ordinarily, we can't access anything in program B. So the only way for that to happen is the OS needs to run, it needs to run in kernel mode. Exceptions are going to be our only way of getting from user to kernel mode. So if any operation requires kernel mode, better do that. And switching from to program B requires kernel mode because normally, we can't access program B stuff. It's not in our memory. We have to change that mapping of addresses. We're not going to be allowed to do that, or else that would defeat the point of not being able to access other programs' memory. So that's going to require an exception to change between one program and another. And also we have to update like the data structures in the operating system that track what program's running now and things like that. And then we have a program exiting. That's going to require an exception because what happens after a program exits? So any volunteers? Yeah.
Releases its memory.
So it releases its memory. Okay, so we're going to change the address mapping. That's one reason. There's something maybe more important that happens. Yeah? We should probably want to run another program. So we need the OS's help to do that. We can't do that ourselves. Okay, so these other things here, I guess we have A, calling a function in the standard library. So the standard library is basically included with our program. It's in the same memory. We don't have to switch to kernel mode to run it. So generally this will be no exception. Now, the caveat here is after we start the standard library function, maybe it makes some system calls, and those would require exceptions. But a way of thinking about this is like a function in the standard library, like stringlens, a function in the standard library. We don't need to run privileged special instructions to find the length of a string. Like that's something we can do. We could write that code. We could do it ourselves in user mode by looking for the null terminator. So there's some ones which clearly don't require any system calls. And if they do have system calls, they're not going to happen when we call them. They're going to happen sometime after that. You know, string, but there clearly are some which should have no exceptions at any point in running the function. And returning a value from one function to another function, this should have no exception. So if you think of how this works, what we're doing to do that is we're setting a register and jumping. These are both things that kind of the processor will let us do without privileged instructions, so we'll just be running entirely in user mode. There's no reason for the OS to get involved to help out. And popping a value from the stack is the same way. So this might have confused some people because you're like, wait a moment, that's changing the amount of memory we have allocated. So usually when the allocation of the stack, the way that works, is basically the OS gives you some stack space and you just keep using it. and you know, when you change your stack pointer, that doesn't actually deallocate the memory. If that happens, that happens at some other time. So even though this conceptually deallocates memory, it's not going to, if the OS is freeing the memory, it's not doing it because you popped a value. Something else has to trigger that. Yes? Question, couldn't F be right if you pop too much? Yes. In that case, I wouldn't, but in that case, I would say you're not really popping a value from your stack, you're crashing.
Okay. And then would any of these require a context switch?
Would any of these require a context switch? And I'll just go through my answer slide for that. So the ones which we said we have to run a different program, so that's C and D, are both cases where we're definitely running a different program. That's what a context switch is. Are we going from one program to another? Okay. Some questions? Yes, back there.
Would all context switches require exceptions?
Question, do all context switches require exceptions? The way we've set things up so far, yes, because the data that we want to load for the switch is stored in the OS's memory, and we're not going to let normal programs access that. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes.
Why does the B require a context switch? Wouldn't we need to, like,
Question, wouldn't we need a context switch so we can run the kernel code? So we do need to run the kernel code. That's going to happen with an exception, which is going to save some values, but it's saving values the same way like a function call saves values. So we're not like loading a set of previously saved things like a context switch does. It's just like a function call saves values, we're saving values in the same kind of way. But a context switch is different, where we're loading some previously saved stuff and saving stuff for much later. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So, why does D require a context switch? That program is done.
The question, why does D require a context switch? Yes, and this is to run whatever to run something else next.
So, do we have to save what was just in the program that exited?
So, question, do we have to save what's in the program that exited? We do not. But we do have to load a new program. Yeah, so we could optimize that context switch by like not doing the first half, but we're still going to have to do the second half. Okay, other questions? Okay. And so when we combine what we've seen here, so we have something called a process. So you may have seen the term process. So a process refers to threads. So that's the illusion that we kind of have our own CPU plus an address space, the illusion we have our own memory. We saw that threads are kind of implemented using exceptions, and our address space is implemented using this memory mapping translation idea. And together, this kind of gives each of your programs kind of a dedicated machine, and we call this dedicated machine a process. And this is kind of most of what operating systems are doing. It's most of the like important operating system work is implementing this kind of process abstraction, this illusion of a dedicated machine that really, you know, is shared between lots of other machines, lots of other pseudo-dedicated machines. Okay, so we're going slower than I thought, but that's okay. So next week's lab is going to be on something called signals. So signals are kind of like a version of exceptions for processes. So hardware exceptions, they happen when the hardware decides it needs to help with the OS. So signals are a mechanism for the OS to decide to run a handler in your program when it decides it needs your help to decide what to do. And it's run in the same kind of way as hardware exceptions are in that something external to your program might trigger it, and it will interrupt whatever code is running and run this signal handler. So we'll talk about how those work next time, and some things that come up when you're writing signal handlers. And then we'll move on to talking about sort of some security topics.